Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you're listening to Total EM. Today we are talking about anaphylaxis in our first ever patient and provider podcast. This type of podcast is about providing information that is relevant both to patients and those who take care of them in emergency medicine settings. I do want to point out that this is still going to be a relatively technical podcast. We are still going to go over information anywhere from basically an early med student role. So there's going to be a lot of technical terms. For those out there who are listening, who are more the patient, and you're trying to figure this information out, I'd highly recommend first that you actually go to the blog and read it. I'm going to try and keep it as basic as possible. And what we're going to do with this is this podcast is actually meant for a little bit higher level, but you can still listen to this if you want to, just to kind of better understand if you were ever in this situation, what we're doing. Now, keep in mind, just like anything else, there are going to be differences in how people do things, but we're going to talk about some of the basic evidence, some of the basic science behind what we're doing. So let's go ahead and get started now. The first thing I want you to remember is to start with the ABCs. This stands for airway, breathing, and circulation. In these patients, keep a close eye on the airway as they may need intubation should there be significant airway swelling that cannot be readily controlled. Mucosal or airway swelling can be defined as swelling to the lips, tongue, or uvula. Check breathing by looking for respiratory compromise. Common findings are difficulty breathing, wheezing, bronchospasm, stridor, or low oxygen saturations, also known as hypoxia. After assessing airway and breathing, check for cardiovascular collapse. This would be seen as reduced blood pressure or other concerning symptoms such as collapse, syncope, or incontinence. Most commonly, there are skin changes, and we usually find these pretty quickly. It often presents as generalized hives, itching, or flushed skin. Something less commonly noted, but also seen and is important, are gastrointestinal symptoms. Think about cramping, abdominal pain, or vomiting with this. Anaphylaxis can be easily missed and potentially deadly. It is defined in different ways, but there are three main criteria that seem to pop up rather regularly, and so we're going to talk about those the most. One is the acute onset of a reaction within minutes or hours involving skin and or mucosa paired with either respiratory compromise or cardiovascular collapse. The second criterion is used for symptom development from exposure to a likely antigen. Any of the following two categories are needed for diagnosis: involvement of skin and or mucosa, respiratory compromise, cardiovascular collapse, or gastrointestinal symptoms. If a patient has a reduced blood pressure after exposure to a known allergy within minutes or hours, this meets the third criterion. Hypotension is usually defined as a systolic blood pressure of less than 90 millimeters over mercury or a 30% decrease of baseline. In children, though, blood pressure for those less than 10 years old is defined differently. At less than a year old is a blood pressure of 70 millimeters over mercury or less. Between 1 year and 10, it is 70 with the age times 2. In essence, think of anaphylaxis when a patient has two or more organ systems involved: skin or mucosa, respiratory, gastrointestinal, or cardiovascular. Patients most often die from asphyxiation due to airway obstruction or cardiovascular collapse. Management becomes the key once anaphylaxis is recognized. So let's go ahead and let's talk about anaphylaxis management. Remember the main thing: epinephrine, epinephrine, epinephrine. Most commonly, epinephrine is given in the muscle. Part of the reason is because administration should not be delayed for IV access. Do not do that. Go ahead, get the medicine in IM sub-Q. It's very easy to do. Know your dosings to get it right. Which we should also mention that there is an association of delayed epinephrine with death. So again, remember to give this early. If needed, you can always repeat doses of epinephrine, either given IM or IV. Given its life-saving importance, commercial auto-injectors are also available, such as EpiPen. That's probably the most common one. However, keep in mind there has been a lot of controversy lately about the cost of EpiPens and similar auto-injectors, but mainly EpiPen is the one that's been out there recently. Again, as always, there are no conflicts of interest. As a provider, remember, when you discharge these patients, you need to give them an epinephrine auto-injector on discharge as a prescription. And I would highly, highly encourage that you get the practice pens and you demonstrate with the patient how to use one of these. Remind patients that they also have two auto-injectors in each pack usually, and that they should keep the two together. We'll talk about that more in a bit. But remember, there are no absolute contraindications for epinephrine and anaphylaxis. During the same time frame you're giving epinephrine, there are other initial measures that are important. For example, remove what could have caused the allergic reaction. This is often forgotten. Think about food exposures. If someone is exposed to food that could have potentially been the cause, have them rinse their mouth out. If you even can, you may even consider using a toothbrush and having them brush their teeth. Antigen removal helps reduce the risk of continued reaction. For medications, this would mean stopping the medication once recognized. Another important point is to call for help, especially if not in a place where definitive care can be given. This is usually if you run across someone out in the public and they seem to be having an allergic reaction. Get that epinephrine again as soon as possible, but make sure to call for help. Other important measures include fluid resuscitation and supplemental oxygen as needed. There are a number of other medications that can be used in addition to epinephrine and anaphylaxis. Patients on beta blockers may be resistant to treatment with epinephrine and can develop hypotension that glucagon could help correct this issue, but the evidence again is limited. And as always, a lot of this information I'm putting, it's going to be in the show notes as far as the links of the research that's related. If epinephrine is not enough for the respiratory issues for wheezing and bronchospasm, consider using bronchodilators such as albuterol. However, there is limited evidence and does not treat upper airway obstruction or laryngeal edema. Again, definitive airway management may be necessary, which includes intubation and possibly even surgical airways such as cricothyroidotomy. Antihistamines such as diphenhydramine and ranitidine should be considered, but there appears to be no direct evidence in their use with treatment in anaphylaxis. Most evidence seems to relate from patients who developed allergic reactions such as hives. However, they can be helpful in certain situations and are often administered. Steroids can be beneficial as well and often given. Usually steroids are given early in anaphylaxis to help reduce the risk of relapse, but there is some debate based on current evidence if it is actually effective. With all these medications, you should ask yourself how to do the dosing. This is one of the things that I talk about with my students a lot. They need to know the dosing of these types of conditions and how to use these medicines correctly. So I'm actually going to talk about it here versus just saying go look it up, because it's very important that you understand this dosing and you know it off the top of your head. There's not a lot of medications that I do that with, but I make sure to mention it for anaphylaxis. Now, traditionally with epinephrine, especially in the auto-injector form, it is 0.3 milligrams in the muscle. For those who are greater than 50 kilograms, a dose of 0.5 milligrams can be used though. Additional doses can be given IM or through an IV as previously discussed. With albuterol, usually 2.5 milligrams is given for bronchospasm if epinephrine is not sufficient. However, you can give more, but this is the traditional dose. In regards to antihistamines, IV doses of diphenhydramine, also known as Benadryl, and ranitidine, also known as Zantac, are given as dosing up to 50 milligrams. Methylprednisolone, also known as Solumedrol, can be given up to 125 milligrams IV or IM. What about if you're treating a pediatric patient with anaphylaxis? Well, as with most medications, it's weight-based dosing. For epinephrine, the weight-based dosing is 0.01 milligrams per kilogram up to the max dose of 0.5 milligrams as previously discussed. When it comes to the antihistamines specified above and methylprednisolone, this dosing is really straightforward. For all three of those types of medications, diphenhydramine, ranitidine, methylprednisolone, they're all 1 milligram per kilogram to their maximum dosing. Pretty easy, right? That's why it's not so hard for me to remember that. There are even more treatments for anaphylaxis, especially when the initial medications do not work. However, now we're starting to get into more complex medications and issues, and really this is meant to be a basic podcast, so we're not going to go through all of that. One concern after the initial management is if there will be a second reaction. This is known as biphasic anaphylaxis, and it is uncommon to say the least. A relatively recent study found that clinically important biphasic reactions are rare, and so are the fatalities. In that study, there were reactions ranging from 10 minutes to 6 days after the initial reaction. Evidence now seems to show that routine monitoring is not beneficial given the rarity. Now, I would like to harp on one thing here for just a minute. I want to go back to airway management, especially if you're a student, you're still learning, or maybe you're fresh out of school, you haven't had to do that many intubations yet. Let's talk about airway management. Like burns and like other conditions, really think early about, do I need to control this airway? If there's significant swelling, if that swelling seems to be getting worse especially, think of it just like the burn patient. Not every burn patient needs to be intubated, but there's a very narrow window when this can all go bad. Really consider this. Talk with the patient early. I usually have a conversation with patients I think may be at higher risk early on with their families if possible and say, hey, this is a real possible risk. I want you to understand why we may be doing this. Do you agree with this? And most of the time, the patients are going to be very understanding. And if it is go time eventually, they're going to be on the plan as well. So when you have this, if this is a really bad patient, you may even need to keep the crash cart just outside the room, or you may even throw it in the room. It's not a bad idea to have this ready to go. And that's why I want to remind you that when you do this, especially when you're intubating these types of patients, these high-risk patients, you may already be too late by the time you recognize it. Hopefully you're not. Hopefully you're on your game. But that is possible. Surgical airways, I know they're things we try and avoid. They make a lot of people really nervous. But this may be the time that you can really save someone's life. Don't wait to intubate someone. And just because you can't pass that tube should not mean that you give up all hope and quit. This is the time the patient needs you the most. And this may be the time you may have to do a surgical airway. Very few people actually have to do one in their career. But this may be one example of a time when you may need to. Just like, again, like those burn patients. When you have surgical airway management, there are many different ways to do this. It is definitely a skill that cannot just be taught over a podcast. I, for one, have been thinking a lot of this over the years, and my favorite technique so far is scalpel finger bougie. This is brought up a lot. It's very basic. You can pull this up at the bedside within moments, especially in the situation when you did not expect there to be a difficult airway. However, I always encourage you to think that every airway is going to be a difficult airway. It saves you a lot of headache. With that said, if you do not know what I'm talking about with the scalpel finger bougie technique, again, go to the blog site or go straight to MCRIT, and you can usually find it there pretty easily. Again, scalpel finger bougie can make a big difference when it comes to a surgical airway. Now I'm done with my little bit of recap there on the airway and my harping on why airway control is so important in these patients. So let's go ahead and let's do a quick review of what we just talked about. Anaphylaxis, it kills people. It can kill your patient easily. A lot of people don't even know that they have an allergic reaction or that they're allergic to some medication, some food, whatever, until it's too late. It's all the more reason why we have to be on our game. And don't forget the ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation. Check the skin, check the mucosa, check for respiratory compromise, check for cardiovascular compromise. Don't forget the gastrointestinal symptoms. So many people forget to check that. Ask about nausea, vomiting, asking about abdominal pain, especially the cramping type of abdominal pain. This can sometimes lead to people who you wouldn't have thought about being anaphylaxis until you ask them about that with their rash. It is very important to remember the gastrointestinal symptoms. They are often forgotten. Again, there are different forms of the criteria. Basically, it is usually a combination of two of those things I was talking about. Skin and mucosa, respiratory compromise, cardiovascular collapse, gastrointestinal symptoms. If they have any combination of those four, think of it that way. And hypotension. Hypotension is part of that too. Also, we need to think about our medicines. Epinephrine, the main one. You got to do that one right off the bat. 0.3 milligrams in most adults, 0.5 milligrams in your bigger people, 50 kilograms or over. You can also think about the weight-based dosing for kids, which is 0.01 milligrams per kilogram up to the max dose. Also keep in mind, ranitidine and diphenhydramine can easily be used up to 50 milligrams per kilogram, and methylprednisolone up to 125 milligrams per kilogram. For any of those three medications, if you decide to use it in a pediatric patient, all of those are going to be 1 milligram per kilogram up to their max doses. Don't forget, biphasic reactions are rare, but they can happen. It's a good reason why to have two auto-injectors. Give those patients those, remind them to have the pins together. Always teach the patient after you give them an epinephrine pin that this is what they need to carry and that they should carry two together. The two main reasons why I tell patients they need to do that, one is for the rare case of biphasic reaction. A lot of my patients live a ways out. Some of them, it may take an hour and a half to even get to their closest hospital. So I want them to know how to use an EpiPen. And I want them to train others too, or get training wherever they can, whether it's through a first aid class or anything else. I want them to try and learn that or teach others the same. And I encourage them that when they get these epinephrine pins, that they keep the two together, not just for the possibility of biphasic reaction. What happens if you incorrectly give it, if it doesn't actually make contact, or if it doesn't work? Maybe there's a possibility that the one pin just wasn't enough, because usually, again, those pins are 0.3 milligrams. Now, there are little tricks you can use with epinephrine pins. Again, that's a lot of wilderness medicine, and that's a different topic we can maybe talk about another time. In summary, though, it is very important that you teach these patients. Make sure you document teaching these patients. Make sure you also emphasize to patients that epinephrine pins should be kept in the appropriate environment. Don't just throw them in your car, especially when it gets really hot or really cold. They should probably keep at least one twin pack, meaning two pins, on their person, one twin pack at home, one twin pack at work. Usually when you prescribe these, you can prescribe up to three of the twin packs. That's six pins. That is the most. It can be very expensive to do that, but make sure they at least get one twin pack, bare minimum, and that you document that you did this, you document you had that conversation. It is so important in case anything happens to these people that you have properly taught them what to do. And this is a great time to use TeachBack, especially if you have those practice pins. When I don't have a practice pin on me, I explain it with a ballpoint pen how to do this. And again, it's a very basic process. All right, well, I think that is a great way to summarize and talk about our first ever patient and provider podcast. Again, this is meant as a little bit of a higher level, still relatively basic, but for my friends out there and family, or just people who are patients in general who are listening, again, this is not meant to teach you how to do this. This is more of an awareness type thing. I would highly encourage you to go to the blog site and actually read the post. The post is going to be a little more basic, and it's going to go over things in a little different detail. Hopefully that will make a little more sense. There will be two blog posts. One is going to be on the emergency professional side, and the other is going to be on the for the public side. Both of them will have this podcast available, so go ahead and listen to it there if you can. If you have ideas for what we could do for future patient and provider podcasts, let me know at thetotalem@gmail.com. You can also find our podcast on Libsyn and iTunes. We are also on Facebook and Twitter. And basically, if you see us, just let us know what you want and what we can do to improve in the future. Again, this is one of our many different podcast types we are trying to figure out and trying to do more of. We hope to talk to you again very soon. Until then, continue to provide total care everywhere.